Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Good evening, and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know. You can find the Commonwealth Club on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. I'm Philip Young, Executive Director and Chief Operating Officer of the Plowshares Fund, and your moderator for this evening's program. Drones and targeted killings. These words we're hearing more and more every day when we watch television, listen to radio, or read the newspapers. Yet, in addition to the media snippets that we get, there's so much more backstory, nuance, and context that is missing and that we're not really aware of. Our guest today is going to take us behind the headlines, the sound bites, to help us better understand how America's approach to combating international terrorism has changed over the years and how we got to where we are today. Mark Mazzetti is a national security reporter for the New York Times based in Washington. He is the author of a new book, The Way of the Knife, The CIA, A Secret Army, and A War at the Ends of the Earth. Copies, by the way, are in the back of the room for you to look at the end of this program. In 2009, Mark shared a Pulitzer Prize for reporting on the stepped-up violence in Pakistan and Afghanistan and Washington's response. The previous year, he was a Pulitzer finalist for reporting on the CIA's detention and interrogation program. Before working at the New York Times, he covered the Pentagon and military affairs for the Los Angeles Times, the U.S. News and World Report, and national affairs for The Economist. He is a student of history with degrees from both Duke and Oxford. We are very pleased that he's come to San Francisco to talk about his reporting, his book, and his experiences. And I want to thank Mark. Above all, he's got a 16-month-old son, and he's taking a lot of time, and I'm sure his wife is waiting for him to come back as soon as possible. So, Mark, thank you very much for coming.
Thank you.
It's a terrific book. This is the kind of thing that you pick up, and you got to continue reading, and you're saying, wow, I didn't realize this has happened. And so I think what would be really good as our first question for you to talk a little bit about why you wrote it, how you came to decide that this was a topic that you wanted to write about, and maybe some of the concerns that you had about writing something like this at this time.
Sure. I want to say, first off, thank you for having me. It's an honor to be here. I know the roster of speakers is so impressive, and it's also a place, being back in San Francisco, where I spent 5 years when I was young, so it's terrific to be back in San Francisco, and it's just as I remember it, 70 degrees and sunny. I was about 7 years old, so my memory might be a little hazy. The reason I wrote the book was because I had been covering these issues for some time, and I felt that we had come to know a great deal about the big wars of the last 11 years in Iraq and Afghanistan, and basically the contours of those wars were pretty well known, but that there had been this whole other group of secret wars that had been as important, if not more important, than what has happened in Iraq and Afghanistan in terms of America's image abroad, in terms of the shape of American foreign policy, and in terms of where war goes into the future. So I thought that as best as possible, I would try to tell a history of some of these secret wars concentrating on Pakistan and Yemen and parts of Africa, because these have been the sort of laboratories for how these wars have been conducted. As a result of these wars, after so many years, a lot has changed. And so I try to get into the sort of what are some of the big changes as a result of not only what has happened on the ground in Pakistan, but what has it done to the CIA, which is traditionally intelligence gathering service. It's increasingly an operational paramilitary organization that's charged by two successive presidents, a conservative Republican, a liberal Democrat, with hunting and killing. Mm-hmm. What does that mean for the CIA? What does it mean for the Pentagon, which increasingly has come to look like the CIA? It's sent soldiers into countries where soldiers haven't traditionally gone to gather human intelligence. Everyone has sort of converged into the same mission. And so I thought that that was those are some of the big themes to get at, but hopefully in the process to write a book that could track certain characters and could track, sort of tell the ground history of the wars, because in many ways that's some of the most interesting things. The people who have played roles are not the ones who are, you know, necessarily the generals or who normally fight wars. It's contractors, it's obscure CIA operatives. So I've tried to sort of put the narrative together that way.
Okay, so let's step back a little bit, because this book covers so many topics. I mean, it's unbelievable. I mean, you talk about different countries, Pakistan, Afghanistan, Yemen, Somalia. There are legal issues, there are economic issues, there's issues about terrorism. Let's start, though, from the basics, where you were talking about the nature of the mission of the CIA, for example, and how that has changed. And then you also talk about the mission of the Pentagon, the military, and how that has changed. So maybe what you can do is start us all off here and talk about what it was before and how it has evolved for both of them.
So the CIA, through its history, since its founding in 1947, has gone through these cycles where it was founded initially as to be an intelligence gathering service to inform the president what's going on around the world. Inevitably, the CIA got into all sorts of various covert activities because presidents throughout American history have relied on the CIA, because secret operations are sometimes more seductive than public operations. So we know about the coup attempts and the assassination plots. And then the cycle is usually they get into trouble for it, and there's airing of the dirty laundry, and then they have to retrench, and then they go through this period of retrenchment, and then they go back at it again once they're blamed for being risk averse.
Okay.
So what happened was in the 1970s, you had the Church Committee investigations, which was this period when there was a lot of recriminations. And from that period, you had officers who were coming into the CIA to get away from, and they were trying, at least at that period, to get away from the really operational paramilitary activities. President Ford signed a ban on assassinations. And a generation of CIA officers were, at least in the outset, taught to be spies, collect intelligence, analyze intelligence, inform the president and policymakers what's going on. Then 9/11 happens, and there was a lot of blame that the CIA, among others, had screwed up and had not been tough enough or aggressive enough in hunting terrorists or getting bin Laden before 9/11 happened. So what you saw immediately after 9/11 was President Bush giving orders to the CIA to basically go around the world and hunt and kill, capture, interrogate, and kill. And so this is the beginning for this new phase of the CIA where, as I said, two successive presidents have basically said, your mission is to be manhunters and is to go around the world and do these paramilitary operations. And that's seen some various phases since 9/11. There was a period immediately after 9/11 in the first few years where you had a CIA focus on interrogation and detention. As we all know, there were secret prisons, and the focus was collect intelligence from these interrogations and see what could be used from that. Over time, the controversy over the interrogations, mm-hmm. Publicly, waterboarding and all that, led the CIA to get out of the detention interrogation business. And as I write in the book, this new strategy of targeted killing in many ways presented a cleaner path. It was cheered by both Democrats and Republicans. So it became this thing that the CIA really became so focused on. So that's the sort of CIA side of things about their history. Now, on the Pentagon side...
So they went from being basically information collectors to actually operational and doing things on the ground.
That's right. And it's not to say that it's always so clean and neat. I mean, certainly people remember the wars of the 80s and during the Reagan administration, where the CIA was very operational, but not with the focus so much on, as I say, targeting individual people and manhunting. This is really a new thing for the agency. And so on the military side, you had on 9/11, the Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld, who was sort of saw the military he had to fight this strange new war, and he thought it was totally ill-equipped. He thought, I've got these big armies, but they can't go into places where Al-Qaeda is. They can't go into Pakistan. They can't go into Yemen. They can't go elsewhere. So he began to push to get new authorities to send soldiers, mostly special operations troops, to go into places where soldiers couldn't normally go, where spies normally went. So you would see troops going into Pakistan, going into Jordan, going into Yemen. And so over the time, over the last 11 years, you've seen this blurring of the lines between the work of soldiers and spies. And the question is, I mean, someone might ask, so what, right?
Yeah,
I mean,
yeah.
Does it really matter? And what are the implications? And I think that there are several. First of all, I mean, the one question that you hear when I talk to current and former CIA operatives is they say, should the... Oh, is this not working? Okay. So they say, should the CIA really be doing this? We already have one Pentagon to be carrying out military activities.
Mm-hmm.
Why do we need a smaller, more secretive version of the Pentagon
yeah.
to be doing this? The other thing is, what are the opportunity costs? The CIA is supposed to be an intelligence collection service. Then what are they missing by doing the manhunting operations? And what they're missing is things like the Arab Spring,
yeah.
where you have this revolt around the Middle East that the CIA is supposed to be keeping the president abreast of, but people in the White House in 2011 were concerned that the CIA was just behind the curve. So these are some of the real implications of this blurring of the lines.
So for Lynn, let's talk about more specifics, which you get into operationally.
Oh.
Okay.
How's this?
All right.
Should I repeat everything I just said?
So operationally then, if for the CIA then to get into being more operational, getting into, what does that mean though? How does that manifest itself? I mean, is it the drones? Go into some of that as you describe. I think that's really interesting. And then on the military side, okay, for the Pentagon, for them to do the more spying, the joint operations, what is it that they need then?
What it means for the CIA is that you've had this this organization within the CIA, which is the Counterterrorism Center, which was this small sort of obscure part of the agency, which has become the, as I write in the book, the beating heart of the agency. It is what drives the agency's operations. It's expanded. It's become incredibly powerful. And what that means is they've become the sort of clearinghouse for, at first, the secret prison program, the detention and interrogations, the information flowed through the Counterterrorism Center. But then, starting around 2004, 2005, increasingly it's been the hub of targeted killing operations in Pakistan at first. And so it is a small group, a relatively small group of people who are making these decisions. And one of the other sort of concerns you could raise is that when you're talking about going to war, which is, you know, pretty much the most important thing a country can do, certainly overseas, the fewer number of people who have oversight over it, and who are examining operations, potentially the riskier it is, the greater potential for going wrong. So you have a relatively small group at the CIA who are answering to the White House, basically proposing operations, drone strikes, we should do this because this person is a terror suspect. And it's very hard for people at the White House to sometimes judge what they're being told. As much as people, you know, could criticize the big lumbering Pentagon, and Pentagon is a huge bureaucracy, especially compared to the CIA,
mm-hmm.
There is a benefit, of course, of these multiple layers of staff under generals who are examining war plans and re-examining and rewriting them to at least have more eyes on what's going on. So I think one of the implications is that you have basically a small group of people running a war in secret, and a war that has been certainly during the first term of the Obama administration expanding.
Okay. And so from the Pentagon side, as they've gone more into sort of the spying and sort of the data collection, can you talk a little bit about how that's manifests itself? And when you've got two people or two organizations sort of trying to do the same thing. There's got to be some conflict that goes on here, right?
Right. And so there was a tradition. There was a lot of conflict in the early years. You have a lot of people who are trying to sort of jockey for supremacy in the in this strange new war. And so Rumsfeld starts sending you know, special operations troops all over the globe, sometimes not without telling the ambassador, the American ambassador in the country where they're going, or the CIA station chief. I mean, there's a sort of infamous example of, yeah. of some special operations guys who go into Paraguay, and nobody knows they're there, and they get into a bar fight, and one guy pulls his gun, and they have to be quickly taken out of the country. But the question was, well, what were they doing there? And the idea was, well, and what were they doing in Paraguay? And it was just gather information for possible future military operations. So what it means is that they, I mean, the authorities the Pentagon got after 9/11 were pretty broad. But what Rumsfeld experienced was they didn't have the capabilities to go do what he wanted them to do. So there's something called the Joint Special Operations Command, which mm-hmm. is the Navy SEALs and Delta Force who do a lot of these. They did the Bin Laden raid most famously. And there's a scene in the book where Rumsfeld goes down to Fort Bragg, North Carolina, to see them for the first time, and a sort of light goes off in his head where he sees them as the army that could prosecute this war that he wanted to wage. But at the time, in 2001, they were small force. They did hostage rescue missions. They basically could sustain themselves for 48 hours. What we see now is they're running entire large parts of the Iraq war, of the Afghan war. They're huge and they have a tremendous amount of authority. They've been running parts of the war in Yemen. So these are large parts of the or parts of the Pentagon that were not large on 9/11 that have become incredibly influential.
So what kinds of things have they been able to? I mean, with money, what are the things that they're able to do? Before it was only for a couple days. Now
right.
they're being able to do it for months or years on end. What does that mean?
Well, it takes. So for instance, you take Iraq. Well, in Iraq, you had the Joint Special Operations Command basically have a large operation, hundreds of people in a base in Balad, north of Baghdad, would go out every single night and do these night missions, these night raids. They would go, knock down doors, interrogate people, get intelligence, get information, go out the same night with that information. It would be this sort of 24-hour cycle. They called it a fight for intelligence. So again, this is the soldiers trying to be more intelligence gatherers. They could sustain these on months and months and months on end. They now do that in Afghanistan with the American involvement in Iraq ending. It's happening to a lesser extent in Yemen because there's been and Pakistan, because there's been these prohibitions about American troops being on the ground. So increasingly, the special operations troops have relied on drones and paying off sources in order to do, you know, more targeted killing operations. Another interesting sort of aspect of this is that, so again, what does it matter if soldiers are starting to act like spies? Well, the concern that you hear in the Pentagon is, you know, there had been brighter lines separating them, where an American spy could go operate overseas, and if that person is caught and jailed, that operation is deniable. That person, the United States would never have to own up to that person working for the CIA, and that person could spend the rest of his life in jail. Well, soldiers traditionally have different authorities. If you're in a war, you operate under the Geneva Conventions. If you're captured, you're a POW. You have to be treated accordingly. With the blurring of the lines, there is concern in the Pentagon that those traditional Geneva Convention protections or the like could ultimately doom troops. I mean, for instance, I'll give you an example. The Bin Laden raid was carried out
right.
actually under CIA authority.
Is what you're talking about, sheep dipping, right?
Yeah, okay. Right. So there's this. What happens is we talked about the early period where the Pentagon and the CIA were fighting for several years, and they got together around 2005 and 2006, and they basically said, we've got to work out some rules here. And so there was this the series of arrangements that got worked out where they basically carved up the world by country. So a place like Pakistan, they said, okay, the CIA is going to be in charge in Pakistan. If there's military involvement, if there's cross-border raids from Afghanistan, it's going to be under CIA authority. And what happened was they basically would instantly turn people into CIA operatives overnight. They call it the term sheep dipping. It's a bureaucratic flick of a switch that you are operating under CIA authority. So the most famous example of this is May of 2011, when teams of Navy SEALs got into helicopters, went from Afghanistan into Pakistan, killed Osama bin Laden, and the entire time they were under the authority of the CIA, because only the CIA is authorized to operate in Pakistan. Now, one could ask, if that operation had gone terribly wrong, and if the SEALs had been captured or killed, the United States would not have been able to deny that operation.
Right.
But this at least gave a fig leaf in order to carry it out under a deniable way and not inform the government of Pakistan that they were doing it.
So maybe, really quickly, how did they divide the world up? I mean, what were the considerations? Presumably there were really political considerations and some legal considerations related to that.
That's right. So it would be dependent on the individual sensitivities in a country for having American troops. So, for instance, Pakistan is Pakistan is so vehemently against the idea of American troops in its borders. So CIA was going to be in charge, and Pakistan's government always insisted that anything the United States did had to be denied. In other words, you do a drone strike, Pakistan takes credit for it. It's not an American drone strike. So Pakistan was an easy one. It was going to be under CIA control. Other countries, though, had a greater willingness to have American troops. So, for instance, the Philippines had a Navy SEAL presence, so the military could operate more openly and sort of be in charge more, as opposed to the CIA having authority. So it depended on what the country's government's disposition was to having American operations, the nature of what they were doing, and who could handle which country at any given time. Toward the end of the book, I talk about how Yemen really became the Pentagon's war, in part because the CIA was so focused on Pakistan. And only after they had done enough in Pakistan and there was the threat in Yemen started to rise, the CIA built a base in Saudi Arabia to do drone strikes in Yemen, and both the CIA and the Pentagon were doing drone wars
drone wars, right.
Yeah.
Okay.
So it's even 11 years later, it hasn't all been worked out, and they're still trying to work out a lot of the rules for this war.
Okay, so we talked about drones. You talked about earlier about this new form of warfare that is sort of coming about. It avoids messy, costly wars that topple governments and require years of American occupation. The government uses a scalpel, a knife, hence the title, rather than a hammer. And would you describe again a little bit more, in a little more detail, some of the issues that you think that arise related to that? And how does this, in your mind, impact American image abroad? We're kind of stepping back now. We've kind of delved into that, but this whole notion of new warfare, and you did mention sort of the implications for the Arab Spring and how, in certain ways, the CIA missed it and when presumably they could have. So,
first of all, the title of the book comes from a speech that is sort of an analogy used by the CIA director John Brennan a couple of years ago when he was the counterterrorism advisor for President Obama. And he was making this distinction between the big wars in Iraq and Afghanistan where the United States has used a hammer. And he said, outside of the war zones, the United States can use a scalpel. But as I write in the prologue of the book, that the idea of a scalpel implies surgery without complications, a war that is clean and cost-free. And that's not always the case. A lot of times it's not the case. And I thought I used a knife because knife fights tend to be a lot messier. Mm-hmm. And that that there are costs and there are consequences to waging war because this is war. So what are the costs? You have a far greater civilian casualties than the government has let on because in many cases, the drone strikes are carried out where, especially in Pakistan, where there's no real specific knowledge now of who they're hitting. They're based on a pattern of activity. So it used to be that if a drone strike was carried out, it would be, we know this person is on the ground, we've been tracking him, we've been following him, we have the authorization to kill him. Now, starting around 2008, they started using what they call signature strikes, which is the CIA examines a group, a pattern of behavior of people, and they're pretty sure that they're up to militant activity, but they don't know necessarily who they are. And so they are authorized to kill without the specific intelligence about who they are. This has led to several cases where civilians were killed, and really strikes gone bad. So there's certainly costs, and this has impacted American relations with the countries in which these wars are waged. I spend a lot of time in the book talking about United States and Pakistan relationship, because I kind of think it's the most interesting relationship the United States has had since 9/11, and the most complicated and the most dysfunctional, and that makes it incredibly interesting for a reporter. And when you go there, and I use this line in the book talking about a CIA operative in Pakistan. You go to Pakistan, and each day you know less than you did the day before. And by the time you leave, you know absolutely nothing.
Nothing.
And it's the world's most, in my mind, the most mysterious place I've ever been, but incredibly interesting. And so I use the example of this growing fracturing of the relationship between the United States and Pakistan. As the United States does more on its own in Pakistan without telling the Pakistani government, things continue to go bad. And there's this moment in 2011 where I sort of go into detail about this case of Raymond Davis,
right,
who was a CIA contractor, which a lot of people, it's this whole issue kind of episode kind of was largely forgotten in the U.S. because 3 months later the Bin Laden raid happened, and that's
right. Yeah, tell us about that. That
sure.
Devoted. I mean, that actually was an article that was that came out in and of itself.
I excerpted it in the New York Times Magazine.
Yeah,
and the reason I decided to spend so much time on it is because it's a really interesting episode, and I'll say what happened. But the second reason is that when you go to Pakistan, people talk about the Raymond Davis episode much more than they talk about the Bin Laden raid. It is the single biggest moment in their mind of what led to the sort of fracturing of the American relationship with Pakistan. So basically, what happens is the CIA is sending more and more operatives into Pakistan, starting around 2008 and 2009, getting them in to the country in all sorts of different covers as diplomats or other ways, and Raymond Davis is a contractor, formerly a Green Beret and formerly worked for the contractor Blackwater, who's working with a CIA team in Lahore, Pakistan. In January 2011, he's driving in a Honda Civic in the streets of Lahore, and he's in traffic, and two men approach him with guns drawn, and he thinks he's getting robbed, and he shoots them both and through the windshield, and then gets out of his car and shoots the second, first through his windshield, and the second when he gets out of his car. He calls for help. An American car from the consulate comes to try to rescue him, but drives down a wrong way street, kills a third person, and then drives away, leaving Davis in the hands of the Lahore police. And he is interrogated by the Lahore police and put in jail. And so the opening scene of the book is the interrogation of Raymond Davis. And what happens then is the Obama administration has a decision to make. They can either come clean and go to the Pakistani government and say, okay, this guy was CIA, this is what he was doing. And there's sort of another level of complexity about why they didn't want to do that, about who he was spying on. But they basically decided we have to say he's a diplomat. We have to say he has diplomatic immunity. So basically Stonewall. It gets worse and worse. The riots in the streets of Pakistan increase. The Pakistani spies knew basically who he was. They're gathering information. And all this time, the CIA is also looking at this house in Abbottabad, Pakistan, trying to figure out whether Osama bin Laden's living there and deciding whether they should do this raid to go get Osama bin Laden. Meanwhile, Ray Davis is sitting in jail.
Right.
And so they ultimately decide to come clean, and they work out a deal with the Pakistani government where what is called blood money is paid, where more than $2 million are paid to the victims of the families of the victims. And this is part of the Sharia law in Islamic law that basically allowed Raymond Davis to get out of his legal situation, and they got him on a plane to Afghanistan. And The reason why I think it's so significant is because, you know, Pakistan's a very conspiratorial place. It's sad in that way, but that people really are in the dark because their government doesn't tell them very much. Right. A lot of people complain that our government doesn't tell us very much, but it's true in Pakistan even more. And the so there's conspiracies, and this sort of confirmed or seemed to confirm all the conspiracies about what the U.S. was doing. You had this former soldier, you had a Blackwater. The contractor is a very big deal. The image of Blackwater is a big deal in Pakistan. And this guy is shot two people. So it was like, aha, we know there are hundreds and hundreds of Raymond Davises running around the streets of Pakistan. And we finally proved it because we've got one sitting in jail.
So we have the larger – so let's continue on Pakistan, because it's by many people, and you hear this a lot, the most dangerous place in the world right now in terms of for national security. It has – nuclear weapons, there are issues with terrorism, some concerns about the internal stability of the country, and then we have this issue related to terrorism, which we're focusing on. Talk a little bit about sort of in the book you describe it, the equities that people are trying to balance here. I mean, you have the ambassador who I've had the pleasure to know. Who's, you know, very mild-mannered, intelligent, very, very skilled, pushing one way, then you have the CIA pushing another. Give us a sense of what's going on there.
So the sort of backdrop during the whole Raymond Davis matter is you have a relatively new American ambassador in Pakistan, Cameron Munter, who, unlike his predecessor, Ann Patterson, is a little more skeptical about what the CIA is doing in Pakistan. The CIA at that point was very, very aggressive in drone strikes in Pakistan. And Munter was not against the drone program, but he sort of thought, well, if we're going after lower and lower level people and potentially angering the Pakistani public, you know, is the benefit worth the cost? So he increasingly raises concerns in his own embassy and also back in Washington about the drone strikes. You have a new CIA station chief who comes in like the day before Raymond Davis was captured, and he's the one who says, no, we're going to stonewall. We're not going to say who Raymond Davis was. Munter and the station chief, who is remains an undercover officer, which is why I'm not saying whose name is, they start fighting. And you asked about the equities. There's this moment where they start, they have a shouting match, Munter and the station chief. And
that I find remarkable that you're reporting that. You know, because Cameron, I've seen him under all kinds of pressure, and he's very cool. Right?
Well, I think it really got heated. And at one moment, the ambassador, you know, the Munter's basically telling the station chief, you know, you're not the ambassador, I'm the ambassador. And the station chief says, listen, I don't want to be the ambassador. In other words, I'm way more important than you are because in Pakistan, the CIA really was in control. So this gets to this sort of bubbles over, and in Washington, there's this big issue. There's this big meeting where the cabinet meets in June of 2011. This is only a month after the Bin Laden raid, and you have some divisions between. You know, Munter is on the call in a conference call or video conference call, and Hillary Clinton, who is his boss, is trying to defend Munter, who's saying, I need some power over these drone strikes. I have to be able to veto them if I think that they're being carried out, you know, at the wrong time or whatever. And then Hillary Clinton and Leon Panetta, who was then the CIA director, they start sort of having tense words. And then Leon Panetta ultimately sort of shuts down Hillary Clinton and pretty much wins the argument in the sense that the Munter was given some greater authority to try to veto potential drone strikes, but then the CIA could appeal the veto to the White House. So it does show that, and this is a big concern in the State Department, is that there is this gradual, there's been this militarization of American foreign policy where ambassadors are no longer really, in certain countries, the people who are in charge. And in a place like Pakistan, I think in many ways that's the case.
So, okay, then that begs the question. Let's talk a little bit, because you go into a lot of detail in the book, about the relationship between and the history between the CIA and the Pakistani Intelligence Service, the ISI. And you, in your earlier comments, alluded to some of that. Can you sort of take us through that? And it seems like at one point after, you know, it was very close, and then there were concerns about the nuclear weapons, and that caused a rift to some degree, and then 9/11 happened, and then it was sort of like, you scratch my back, I'll scratch yours, and then suddenly things kind of went really sort of in a very different direction. Talk about that and the personality.
Sure. So American-Pakistani relations in a nutshell, you have basically, you know, during the Cold War, you had, you know, the alliances sort of broke down, where the Americans and the Pakistanis were sort of aligned, whereas the Soviets in India were much closer. So America and Pakistan were pretty close, and famously during the war in Afghanistan in the 80s, you had the CIA and the Pakistani spy service, the ISI, running the guerrilla war in Afghanistan against the Soviets, and ultimately driving out the Soviet army. So that was the period of pretty good relations in the 80s. In the 90s, the war in Afghanistan, that part of the war ends. Pakistan develops its own nuclear program. There are sanctions, and there's a whole decade where they sort of they grow apart, which is probably, when America and Pakistan are concerned, these cooling off periods are not bad things necessarily. It's sometimes when they're too close where everyone gets sick of each other. And then 9/11 happens, and again, once again they're thrown together, where Pakistan is perceived as the place where, after Afghanistan, where all the Al-Qaeda operatives are living. And initially, there is a period of very pretty good relations between the CIA and the ISI. And when I was in Pakistan last summer doing research for the book, I interviewed the station chief, the ISI station chief at the time in Peshawar, which is the westernmost city of Pakistan, closest to the tribal areas like North Waziristan and South Waziristan, a big market city, very important city. And he recalls quite fondly his working with the CIA and hunting down some of these Al-Qaeda operatives. And so that's the early period. And then slowly around 2003, then in 2004, the CIA wants to start really getting into the drone business. And it wants to get drone strikes into Pakistan. And this had been a big point of contention between President Musharraf's government and the United States. The way they got the foot in the door, the first drone strike happened in June of 2004. First drone strike in Pakistan was killed a pretty much an enemy of the state of Pakistan. Not that he was not a concern of the CIA, but he was more of a concern of the Pakistanis. And the Pakistanis said, if you can hunt and kill this guy, go do it. And that was paved the way for the drone strikes in Pakistan. And really paved the way in many ways for the unraveling of the relationship, where the drone strikes continue. The U.S. starts thinking that maybe the Pakistanis are tipping off Al-Qaeda to the drone strikes because they weren't going well. They were hitting civilians. The intelligence was bad. And that leads to this period in 2008 and 2009 when, starting with the end of the President Bush administration and into the Obama administration, there's this surge of drone strikes. You know, we're talking from a dozen or so up to 2008 to now hundreds. And these are all done without asking the Pakistanis' permission. They just go, you know, the Bush administration decided to go to just basically present this to the Pakistani government as a fait accompli, we're going to do this. So this is the gradual unraveling that where the U.S. doesn't trust the Pakistanis, who they suspect are helping the Taliban in Afghanistan. It gets very complicated. The Pakistanis suspect that the United States is secretly helping India in Afghanistan. So there's all this web of alliances where no one quite trusts each other. I should say, just really stepping back, that at the end of the day, Pakistan worries most about India. They don't worry about militancy in Afghanistan. They don't worry necessarily about militancy in their own country, although it is a growing problem, and it's led to, you know, thousands of Pakistanis dying in terrorist attacks. India remains their focus. And so when the United States has tried to push Pakistan in the direction of go deal with the militant problem, the pushback has usually been, we've got this nuclear neighbor that is way bigger than we are, richer than we are, and has a much bigger army than we have, so we have to focus on them.
So it's the idea, though, for Pakistan is it's not only the military, it's not only the nuclear weapons, it's also the militants, and the radicals are really part of their defensive principles as they move forward.
It always had been, and this was why. I mean, people would wonder why was Pakistan so tolerant of the Taliban before 9/11? It wasn't that they saw that Pakistani generals saw eye to eye with the Taliban. It was that they saw the Taliban as this useful proxy force who could basically keep Afghanistan quiet while Pakistan worried about India. And so Pakistan's strategy historically has been, in its western border, is to use some of these groups to basically be the defense. And so they don't have to worry about it. But over time, as we've seen, these militant groups have changed. Some of them have started attacking into Pakistan itself. So then Pakistan realized it had a double problem. It had India and it had some of these militant groups. But every time they went in there and tried to fight the militant groups in the mountains, which is outside of their comfort zone, they lost. And so it remains a big problem, and it remains an issue where Pakistan's military does not want to go into these areas because they're afraid of the consequences.
Okay. And let's talk about prognosis here, what you think may happen in the future. Where do you think the relationship between the U.S., can the relationship be repaired? Can the relationship between the CIA and the ISI, the Pakistani intelligence service be repaired? Can the relationship be repaired? What do you think?
I mean, I think it's not going to anytime soon be like it was. Not that it was even that great after 9/11, but as good as it was. The succession of events, the Raymond Davis matter, the Bin Laden raid, there was a few events that year that basically really were the nadir of the relationship. It can get better. It's a little bit better from where it was in 2011, but the U.S. and Pakistan have little tolerance for each other right now. And so Pakistan has looked for other countries to be closer to. They're very close to Saudi Arabia. They look to the Chinese and China to be its new United States, but the Chinese are somewhat wary of Pakistan. Again, I think we're probably going to enter one of these cooling off periods where where both sides kind of go to their corners and not be in each other's business so much, and maybe that's not the worst thing in the world. I don't think the United States and Pakistan will stop being allies. We will keep an alliance, but it's not going to be like it was.
There are a lot of questions, and I'm sort of interweaving now questions from the audience. Thank you very much, about drones. And let's start with sort of a basic fact from your is drone killing an effective counter to suicide bombings? Will it reduce those over time? And I think the larger question, is it really having an effect on our war on terror, which in certain ways seems to be the justification for that and keeping us safe?
Big, broad question, important question, hard to answer, but I'll try. I mean, it's one of the most important questions to ask. There's no question that Al-Qaeda as it existed on 9/11 is a shadow of what it was. I mean, the leadership is captured or killed, and the drone strikes have had a lot to do with that. And they have also had an impact on leadership in Yemen and elsewhere in parts of Somalia. The question is, though, after you go after the leadership of these organizations using drones on mid-level or low-level operatives, or with these signature strikes where you're not even quite sure who you're going after, and in the process sometimes killing civilians or killing people you didn't intend to, is that having a radicalizing effect? And are you, as Rumsfeld sort of famously once questioned, are you creating more terrorists than you're killing?
Right.
And that's the question that is being asked. And I think it's something that is almost impossible to say at this moment in the middle of 2013. I mean, there are concerns about, for instance, anecdotally, in May of 2010, you had a man, American man, who tried to blow up Times Square with a truck bomb. He was unsuccessful. But So he was brought into court, and his somewhat famous testimony, he said, you know, the reason why I did this was because he was Pakistani, naturalized American citizen of Pakistani descent. He said, I did this because of the drone strikes in Pakistan. So it was having this effect of, you know, radicalizing those just because the idea of remote control killing by a superpower had focused the minds of people to strike back. We don't know enough about what the motivations of the Boston Marathon bombers were yet.
Yes.
However, and it will take weeks or months to know, I think. But it does appear that they at least were motivated. What had partly been radicalized, at least the older brother, was this idea of the American wars abroad. And it's interesting, the latest intelligence seems to indicate that these two guys did not have ties to international terrorist groups. They were not Al-Qaeda. They were not they may have just been operating on their own. And I think part of the question is that a good or a bad thing? Mm-hmm. I mean, does it make you feel safer that they were not dispatched by someone in Chechnya or Pakistan to go carry this bomb? They just became radicalized. They learned how to build these bombs on the internet, and they went and blew up the Boston Marathon. I mean, it is possible, and I don't want to get ahead of myself because I don't think we really know. But the future could be more of this: these people who have been radicalized, and so then the question is it all worth it? I mean, these are the calculations that the government has to make about. That doesn't mean that the drone strikes in and of themselves have been bad. I mean, there is a case for drones if you're comparing them to carpet bombing, certainly. And they are more precise. You can be more discriminating in terms of who you're killing. But it doesn't mean that there are not costs and consequences.
Okay, just hold that thought for a second. I have to make an announcement. This is the Commonwealth Club of California program, and we are talking with New York Times national security reporter Mark Mazzetti about his new book, The Way of the Knife. I'm Philip Yan, your moderator. You can hear Commonwealth Club programs on the radio and also see video of the programs online at Fora TV. One question we have here talks again about the drones, and it's an interesting question about what's the end goal of the drone wars? Does it not set sort of a circumstance where other people are going to be using them against us as well? And isn't this going to be something that is going to continue? And in a sense, what is the finish line? I think this talks about some of the implications you just ended with.
Great question. I mean, in many ways, the United States has sort of set the rules of the game with the drone wars. Now, it should be pointed out, actually, the real pioneers of drone technology were the Israelis before the United States got into it, and they developed unarmed predator-like weapons, and then armed predators. But really, the U.S., the way the U.S. has used them has sort of led to a mini proliferation of drone technology, where there's dozens of countries who are developing drones, both armed and unarmed. What that will mean is that they are likely to use them, and that they will use them probably with the same justifications that the United States has used drones over the last 11 years. In other words, self-defense, using them against terrorism. So if the Russians want to do drone strikes in Chechnya based on the justification that there are terrorists there and they are acting in their self-defense, it will be difficult for the United States to, you know, go internationally and say, no, you can't do that, that's not allowed, because the Russians would be using, you know, the same justification. So I think that that's the implication in terms of geopolitics, in terms of these other countries developing drone technology and using them. Inside the United States, I think, well, there's the issue of are we going to start seeing drones on, you know, the streets? And
right.
I mean, I think that there's already law enforcement organizations using unarmed drones for surveillance. The Customs and Border Patrol uses drones along the border. It is not at all science fiction. I think it's not at all implausible. I think it's probably possible that you will see drone strikes in the country they don't, not necessarily with the big predators that are used in Pakistan, but I mean, if you think about it, if a police force has the authority to take a sniper and kill someone who they suspect is holding people hostage or hold up somewhere and he poses a threat, if they have authority to kill him with a sniper, they could very easily use the same authority to use, you know, to use a drone. There was the instance of recently in California, in Southern California, where the person had shot several policemen and was holed up in that cabin. I mean, 5-10 years from now, you could see a police force using a drone to kill him.
Mm-hmm.
This is all very, very possible. And so one of the reasons why, going back to why did I write this book,
yeah,
right, is that I thought that that there just needed to be more discussion about all of these issues. Just because war is carried out in secret doesn't mean it's not war. And I think 11 years after 9/11, more than 11 years, it's time that people have a better understanding about what has happened, because this increasingly is the sort of default way we go to war. I don't think there's going to be another. My own prediction is that in the next 10 years, we're not going to see another war like Iraq. But we're going to see a lot more wars like Yemen.
Mm-hmm.
And so people need to know sort of how these wars are waged.
Someone asked about the process, and this is the last question I'll ask about drones and the signature strikes, and it's the notion that how they come about, how they are decided upon. Interesting question. It says, there been an instance where a signature has been forged, or is there a way for a particular organization or party within the U.S. government or whomever to, quote-unquote, game the system? And I was wondering if you had thought about that at all.
And in terms of sort of saying cooking the intelligence,
yeah,
about
cooking the intelligence to justify a strike on for a preconceived notion or reason.
Well, I mean, there has been divisions within the government about intelligence over specific operations, and the timing of strikes. Now, going back to the Raymond Davis example, the day after Raymond Davis was released from prison, the CIA carried out a drone strike that killed dozens of people. It turns out, I mean, by almost all estimates, it was one of these signature strikes that went very badly. They hit a tribal meeting. It was not a gathering of militants. And people in the Pentagon, people in the State Department were furious. Cameron Munter, the ambassador, was furious. There was this suspicion that, and I don't say definitively in the book because it's very hard to prove, but the suspicion was that the CIA was so angry over the way the Raymond Davis matter was handled that this was some kind of a payback. Not that they went and killed innocent people deliberately, but that they carried out this strike thinking that it was a militant strike, but it was a big attack. And that this was, this specific strike is still debated, in the government about, who it hit and why it was carried out on that day. Everyone in Pakistan is convinced it was deliberate, again, going back to the Raymond Davis matter. And so it's individual instances like this that in many ways undercut the drone program, which has not, I mean, it should be said that the evidence is largely that for the most part the drones have limited civilian casualties, but again, you can't do it entirely.
Let's switch to some legal questions. There are several, actually. They talk about how does the U.S. Constitution fit into these secret wars. It talks about the killing of American citizens. You mm-hmm. talk about one individual in one circumstance in your book. And how do you believe the new authority granted to the CIA since 9/11 affects U.S. foreign policy and the effect of future precedent from a legal standpoint?
So there's a couple different legal aspects here. As I said earlier, there's a ban on assassination on the books that President Ford signed, that you can't go kill a foreign leader. Assassination has taken a political term, that it's the idea of a head of state that you couldn't just go kill. Post 9/11, the armies of government lawyers basically began making the case that, you know, this is war. This is not, we're not responding to 9/11, by getting the FBI to collect evidence and put these people on trial. The idea is that everyone around the world who's helped carry out this attack, we are at war with, and these are military strikes. So when you say constitutionally, you've seen this broad expansion of executive power under the powers that the president has to carry out war. The president can authorize the CIA to go capture and kill, as President Bush did. Congress, a week after 9/11, gave the Pentagon, and really broadly the Bush administration, very, very broad authority to basically respond to the 9/11 attacks. It's called the Authorization for Use of Military Force. So as long as you define the world as a battlefield, then, as basically has been done, then any one of these individual strikes is a military operation, which is justified constitutionally by the powers of the president. Now a lot of people will, you know, there's a lot of discussion now about, you know, these authorities were way too broad after 9/11. They need to be redrawn. The issue of the American citizen is particularly interesting because it came up, there had been Americans killed in drone strikes up until 2011, but it was in the person of Anwar Aleki, who was a radical cleric American citizen born in the United States in New Mexico, who then moved to Yemen and increasingly turned radical in sort of preaching hatred against the United States, preaching attacks. And he, or at least inspiring people who carried out attacks. And the Obama administration basically had to decide, is it legal, is it constitutional to kill this person who remains an American citizen? So there's this period where the Justice Department has these debates, and they basically find a legal justification, arguing that this person, it poses a direct threat. They pose an imminent danger. They are no longer really American citizens because they're committed to waging war against the United States. But these are the thorny sort of legal questions that, and I'm not a lawyer, but that are still being sort of in the process of being worked out.
So, what I was struck by some of the things that you're talking in the book is that people from, you talked about earlier about people becoming enamored with secrecy and the drones and the technology. And you have this phenomenon of people who were out of government, who had been, in certain cases, very outspoken against what was going on. And then once they come in, somehow something changed. Or that they weren't sort of, the policies that were coming out weren't necessarily what you expected from those individuals or who worked on those. Can you talk a little bit about that in terms of, you know, why do you think that is? Or is that my interpretation may not be quite correct?
Well, I mean, for instance, so you have in the Obama administration, you have several members of the Obama administration who were vehement critics of the Bush administration and the counterterrorism policies, especially the detention, interrogation, torture issues. One of them, Harold Koh, who was the dean of Yale Law School, and, you know, a very liberal critic of the Bush administration's policies. Harold Koh takes over the top legal job at the State Department and finds himself publicly defending targeted killings. And has been vilified by many in the left for doing so, and he's tried to publicly explain why he's taking this case. That, you know, things look different when you're on the inside
right.
than they look when you're at Yale Law School, and he's now back at Yale Law School. So it'll be interesting ultimately how he's received. but it's interesting because he by most accounts, he was a voice of caution in internal debates over, you know, always wanted to be sure that they were being careful on these strikes and thought he was trying to rein in some of the impulses of the CIA. But at the same time, it was a case of the Obama administration sent Harold Koh out publicly to talk about this stuff, the justifications, in part because of who he was.
Right.
Because he carried a lot of weight.
Okay. You have in this book, there are a lot of interesting characters that you sort of talk about and really make come to life. And I would say, in certain ways, some eccentric characters described in your book who are part of a privatization of intelligence operations. For example, you talk about a woman named Michelle Ballarin, who is a Virginia entrepreneur who is fixated on Somalia. At the time, the CIA was focusing on the country and convinced the Pentagon to give her a contract inside Somalia. Can you talk about her in the context of using private firms and individuals for intelligence gathering, and what you saw the benefits and the drawbacks for that?
Well, I mean, the big theme in part is that when you go to war outside of war zones and you can't send in the Marines, you send in all sorts of different types of people, and a lot of the work of contractors really has expanded. So contractors to gather intelligence, contractors to protect CIA officers, contractors to be hired on killing missions. Michelle Ballarin was a way for me to sort of discuss Somalia, which is the place where since 9/11, the country that everyone suspected as a big problem, but no one really wants to go there mm-hmm. to deal with. There's the image of Black Hawk Down, and the Pentagon was basically determined they're not going to have another major combat battle in Somalia. So they would rely on proxy forces. There was a period in 2006 when the CIA armed Somali militias to battle Islamists, and that went horribly wrong. And it ended up empowering the people who they were trying to run out of power. So then there's all these different attempts to gather intelligence, and so Michelle Ballarin comes along, and she is a former candidate for Congress in West Virginia. She lives out in the horse country of Somalia. She becomes obsessed with, the horse country of Virginia.
Virginia, yeah.
Okay. She becomes obsessed with Somalia and basically gets hired by the Pentagon for not a large amount of money, but the idea that the Pentagon would hire her to gather information is just very illuminating. Where she would go in and sort of talk to some of her various allies there. And the idea was to build up intelligence networks to even eventually start training armed militias who might battle the Wahhabi radical strain of militancy in Somalia. And she got involved in pirate negotiations. There's a colorful scene where the pirates, she calls herself Amira, A-M-I-R-A, which means princess in Arabic. And there's a scene where there's some pirates who have taken over a ship, and all of a sudden the negotiations break down, and they drape a sign over the hull of the ship that just says Amira. And the idea being, we want to negotiate with her. So she gets involved in negotiations. She keeps showing up in these places. And the idea is not to say she is the central character for American policy in Somalia over the last 10 years, but to sort of highlight how, in this very strange experiment in warfare we're in, how sort of fringe characters can play outsized roles. And so I spend about a chapter and a half just talking about her and her efforts in Somalia. Hopefully, is my goal to illuminate the bigger issues of dealing with counterterrorism in a place like Somalia.
So, I mean, and you talk about Blackwater as well, and so you feel that. How do you feel? Do you feel from what you're reporting, do you feel that's a good thing? Do you think it's a bad thing?
Well, I think that a company like Blackwater came along at the right perfect time, because they from their perspective, certainly, because the CIA, the Pentagon, the State Department were desperate for, they were stretched so thin, especially the CIA, so they would hire outside contractors and hire Blackwater to do functions like intelligence gathering, like protecting case officers, that government employees used to do. So the idea of what is government work and what is contracted work has dramatically changed over the last 10 years. You would think that government employees should carry guns, should spy, should kill. Well, and that's not always been the case. So the danger of of having so much, and it's not just Blackwater. Blackwater is just a very sort of it's an example that's received a lot of attention, and they are now changed their name, but they've had trouble staying out of the news. It's the question of whether when you outsource fundamental missions that were the work of U.S. government. Where do the loyalties of those people lie? Do they lie with the company? Do they lie with the nation? Sometimes they can be in conflict. I think that's part of the danger.
Okay. Number of questions related to your reporting. Very sensitive information, not necessarily publicly available. How did you find your sources? And tell us about the reporting process itself and how you were able to collect certain data, and some anecdotes about something that perhaps was a little bit unexpected as you sort of dove into this for the very first time.
It's hard. Is the short answer. I try to explain. I have a note on sources in the back of the book about how you're writing about an ongoing war that at least officially remains a secret. So. And in a climate right now in Washington where there are people going to jail for talking to reporters, there's a real crackdown on information. The people who agree to talk are sometimes doing it at their own personal risk. The people who I spoke to are people who, for the most part, I had relationships with over the years, who had come to trust me and I'd come to trust them with the information. And sometimes they introduce me to people and I meet them, other sources through them. It's piecing together information that you're conscious of only knowing in some ways a fraction of the story, but you can help build the fuller story by public accounts, reported accounts of events. There's been, whatever you think of the WikiLeaks information that came, the diplomatic cables, that has been a resource for historians and for journalists to find out about what the U.S. government was thinking at a particular period of time. There are some declassified documents. There aren't many, but there are some. And as I explain, as much as possible, I try to use declassified documents to paint the narrative. But when the war is still going on, there hasn't been much that's been declassified. As I write, you always want to quote people on the record. You always want to have on the record interviews, but it is just impossible in so many cases to get someone to talk to you and have their name attributed to it because they frankly don't want to go to jail. And you have to sort of judge that. You say, okay, you take that person's information and you don't just put it in the book. You have to bounce it off other things. So it's a very careful process that takes, what sort of the surprising thing about the process was the writing of this was in many ways the easier part, than gathering information where you're trying to, you have this, I've never written a book before, so you're basically gathering and gathering and you're becoming increasingly stressed about what you have, and it's amorphous, and the actual structure of putting the structure together was incredibly hard. Writing was hard too, but you could at least go in every day. When I wrote a rough draft, I basically just said, I'm going to write a certain amount of words today. And you did your 1,000 words, and you went home, and you knew you could rewrite later. It allowed you to chip away at a final product, and at least feel like you were making some progress. Because otherwise, if you're just gathering all the time, you won't get anywhere. And there was at least a small feeling of accomplishment at the end of each day of writing.
So. Throughout, as a reporter, you have to have some healthy skepticism about all the stuff that you hear. You have to verify it. But is there something that you learned substantively that you said, wow, that's something. I had no idea. That really surprised you in a way that you hadn't expected.
That's a good question. I mean, the one specific... I mean, one specific example is I did not think that I was going to be spending so much time talking about the country of Yemen. I mean, I knew it was important, and knew it was important to the narrative, but as I dug deeper into operations there, you had, I guess to some degree, that the haphazard nature really surprised me, where you had the Pentagon running the war for a period of time, but then it doesn't go well, so the CIA takes it over, and then they both start running it. It's one thing that it surprised me, and I decided to then, actually the final chapter of the book is this convergence of the CIA and the Pentagon in Yemen, and then there is an epilogue to the book, but that's the final chapter. And so that was...
Why don't you talk about that a little bit?
About this convergence?
Yeah.
So basically the final chapter is basically ultimately the rise of the drones and in Yemen, and you have sort of parallel... There's two sort of parallel studies of Anwar al-Awlaki, who I described earlier, who was killed by a CIA drone strike. 2 weeks later, another drone strike killed his son, his 16-year-old son. And no one I've spoken to has ever said that this was anyone thought he was a militant. It was a horribly botched operation where he was with other people and the intelligence was bad, and he was another American citizen. Mm-hmm. And that was the best that I've been able to glean was carried out by the Pentagon. So you have the CIA drone killing the father and the Pentagon drone killing the son within 2 weeks of each other. And this question becomes, who's running this war, and why is it being run this way? And I thought it was just in a book about the blurring of the lines and the convergence of the mission, I thought that it was a good way to sort of take one example of one family in one place and see the impact.
You've put all this time into looking at the agency, at the CIA. One question is, 10 years from now, where do you think it will be? What do you think its mission will be about? This constant tug of information gathering or operational? What's your prediction?
Well, I think going back to this idea of that things always happen in cycles, there's a good chance, there's at least public talk of the CIA getting more out of this paramilitary business. John Brennan, the new CIA director, has hinted he would like, he's an old CIA hand himself, he has indicated he would like the CIA to be less paramilitary. At the same time, Brennan has been for 4 years working at the White House overseeing the drone wars, which have made the CIA more paramilitary. So the question is that a serious thing? Is he going to try to push the CIA back into more of the classic espionage intelligence gathering? I think he will. I mean, I think he will try. I think they might try to move some of the drone operations from the CIA to the Pentagon. But a couple things. I don't think the CIA will give up this authority. I don't think the president, whoever comes in after Barack Obama, will want the CIA to give it up, because I think, again, presidents like to preserve this option for using the CIA to carry out these secret missions. And so you will see a CIA retain this. I think the reason why 10 years from now it's hard... Reason why maybe 10 years from now, as opposed to 1 year from now, the CIA might be more back in its sort of traditional missions, because you have, these are generational things. You have people trained in a certain way. And as I say toward the end of the book, you have now sort of a generation of CIA officers who have been pushed into this mission of manhunting and killing, which is really different than the mission of going to China and trying to develop sources to spy on the Chinese government, which is, again, the sort of classic espionage work of the CIA, right, as opposed to finding information to do manhunting. These things take time to retrain. New generations have to come in to learn these skills. And so some of the concern you have among older generations of CIA officers and retired ones is that those skills are being lost, and with this push towards manhunting. And so that's where I think any change that's going to happen is going to take a lot longer than some might think.
Okay, last question. Everyone here, we've listened to you, great comments and remarks for the last hour. If they leave, walk out this door, what are the two things or three things that you want them to take from what we've from our discussion here?
There's been a whole other war out there that we haven't known about, or that we haven't known enough about. And when I say we, I mean everybody. I mean people. I mean reporters. I mean the congressional intelligence committees who have oversight over the CIA and who are the handful of people who are supposed to have access to the highest levels of classified intelligence. We found out in the John Brennan hearing that they didn't even have the legal memos justifying the underpinnings of the drone strikes. The executive branch had denied Congress those. So those guys don't even know as much as they should about all of this. I think that so one takeaway I think is that there should be a push to learn more, to have more transparency and to have more accountability for these kinds of secret operations. I mean, the second thing is that this is, I think, I mean, this laboratory over the last 10, 11 years is what has emerged from the lab is really what in many ways the future is. And if you add things like cyber war and things like that, it's going to be less of armies clashing and even the counterinsurgency fights of Iraq and Afghanistan, and more these sort of shadow wars that are harder for people to get details about, and also they're easier for governments to wage in secret. And my hope is that at least there will over time be more transparency in how these are waged, so people can then know whether this is a good or bad thing.
Our thanks to our guest, Mark Mazzetti. He is the New York Times national security reporter and author of a new book called The Way of the Knife, The CIA, A Secret Army, and a War at the Ends of the Earth. We also want to thank our audience here and on radio, television, and the Internet. I'm Philip Yun, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know, is adjourned.
Thank you. I hope that was all right.
Is that okay?